The establishment of the fine arts and their division into various categories go back to a time that differed radically from ours and to people whose power over things and circumstances was minute in comparison to our own. However, the astounding growth that our resources have undergone in terms of their precision and adaptability will in the near future confront us with very radical changes indeed in the ancient industry of the beautiful. In all arts, there is a physical component that cannot continue to be considered and treated in the same way as before. No longer can it escape the effects of modern knowledge and modern practice. Neither matter, nor space, nor time is what, up until 20 years ago, it always was. We must be prepared for such profound changes to alter the entire technological aspect of the arts, influencing invention itself as a result, and eventually, it may be, contriving to alter the very concept of art in the most magical fashion. Paul Valéry, Pièce sur l'art. The Shadow Traps, Episode 16. The Purpose of Film as Revealed in a Discussion about Wallpaper. The opening passage was by Paul Valéry. I found it quoted in The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction by Walter Benjamin and have simply copied that quotation from Benjamin's book into my own podcast, making it a particular kind of reproduction. I'm going to talk at some length and without apology about wallpaper. And that's because I have a theory that much of what the Laprinces might have believed about film and its place in the world can be detected in a clutch of writings about wallpaper and in fact about home furnishings in general. This theory might be misconceived, but I think it's worth pursuing anyway. We don't have a wealth of information on the Laprinces at this stage in their lives, but what we do have, I think, might be important. And we have some information on their ill-fated involvement with John Whitley's latest scheme, the promotion of the Lincruster-Walton wallpaper process in the United States. And Lincruster-Walton has an overlooked connection with film, in that, like film, it is an example of an artistic material created through mechanical reproduction. And so, the artistic controversies that surrounded Lincruster-Walton and the Laprinces' attitude towards them might allow us to extrapolate and imagine how Louis Laprince might have seen the place of the motion picture camera in society set against the traditions of the handmade and the unique. But to do this, we will need to go back and look at the story of Lincruster-Walton, and actually back a bit more to start with a story of another material, linoleum. According to the story, a Mr. Frederick Walton found, on the top of a jar of paint, a skin of oxidized linseed oil. He peeled it off and was fascinated by its rubber-like qualities, which he decided to put to use somehow. And so, in 1860, after a series of experiments, Walton obtained the first of several patents that would become the basis for the development of a material he named linoleum, from linum, which was Latin for flax, from which linseed oil is made, and oleum, the Latin for oil. Walton's linoleum was oxidized linseed oil mixed in with ground cork dust, gums and pigment, all of which were pressed onto a canvas base by heavy rollers. This created a floor covering that was both durable and affordable. Walton created the Linoleum Manufacturing Company and set up a factory to produce the floor covering. Within 2 years, it was exporting products across Europe and the United States. In 1872, almost a decade after the Linoleum Manufacturing Company's birth, Walton travelled to the United States where, with Joseph Wild, he established the American Linoleum Manufacturing Company. Over the next 2 years, a linoleum manufactory was built on Staten Island alongside a company town known as Linoleumville. According to A History of English Wallpaper, following Walton's success with linoleum, it occurred to him that the material was capable of development in another totally distinct way. Instead of applying it to floors, he would, with some variation in its manufacture, apply it to walls, but with a modelled surface in relief. Lincrusta Walton was again a resin-based material, but meant this time as a wall covering, although it would extend far beyond that. Walton patented this new material in 1877 and initially called it linoleum muralis, which was basically linoleum for walls. However, he was forced to reconsider by a court case that might have been a reminder to Whitley and LePrince in years to come of the importance of patents. Linoleum had proved so popular that when Walton's patents expired in 1877, rival firms appeared with their own versions of the product. Walton took one such company, the Scottish firm Nairn, to court for infringement on the linoleum trademark. However, Walton had failed to ever register the actual name linoleum as a trade name. In 1878, the courts ruled against Walton for a particular reason. The court ruled that the word linoleum had become so widely used that it was considered common property. It seems that Frederick Walton had become a victim of his own success. It also might have provided a salutary lesson for Whitley and LePrince in later years regarding the importance of names and patents. And so Walton changed the name from Linoleum Muralis to Lincrusta Walton, and this time made sure to get a registered trademark to protect the name. As a quick digression, this also means that if you see linoleum written down, it usually has a lowercase L, while Lincrusta, which is a registered trademark name, has a capital L. And another quick digression. In a later biographical sketch of John Whitley, which I suspect had been commissioned by Whitley himself, it was claimed that it was he who thought up the name Lincrusta Walton. This might well have been the case, but it is hard to be sure. I have always seen John Robinson Whitley as an unreliable narrator. Anyway, this name came from linum, the Latin for flax or linseed oil, and crusta for relief. And we know from previous episodes that something in relief is something that has depth, that reaches out to the viewer. And it was so in the case of Lincrusta Walton, because the patterns on the wallpaper were usually embossed. And so, once again, we encounter the 19th century fixation with relief and depth already prevalent in photography. Lincrusta was based on the same material as linoleum, oxidized linseed oil. However, instead of ground cork dust serving as a binder, wood pulp was used, and again the mixture was pressed between heavy rollers. This time one of the rollers was engraved, and this created the embossed designs. Or, as a Journal of Decorative Arts put it, the embossing machine leaves a sharp and clear outline, which, however, if desired, may be touched up by hand. When in process of being wrought, it is soft and pliable, but in a few hours' time, it becomes hard. It will resist blows and abrasions, and should it be struck a sharp blow with a hammer, the indentation would not be long apparent, as a gap would fill up with the elastic substance. To start with, Lincrusta was pressed, as linoleum was, onto a canvas backing, although this would prove too stiff and be replaced with a waterproof paper backing in 1887. Even so, Lincrusta could imitate wood panelling, stamped leather and decorative plaster. These things in their original forms were incredibly expensive, which was played on by Walton in his advertising. The firm proclaimed, for example, solid in colour, solid in relief, solid in value. While linoleum was more cheap and cheerful, shall we say, Lincresto Walton was considered more artistic and was used in middle and upper middle class establishments such as restaurants, hotels, parlours and yachts. The history of English wallpaper tells us it was extensively used in ships, yachts, railway carriages and tram cars. For shop fronts and fascias, it proved very effective and durable, being particularly adaptable for exterior decoration through its imperviousness to the weather. There was another aspect to Lincresto Walton which was important and timely. It was considered easy to clean. The robust wall covering could be wiped down without being damaged, and this particular quality dovetailed with an increasing awareness in the 19th century of the dangers from germs caused by uncleanliness. Lincresto Walton would go on, for example, to win a gold medal at the International Health Exposition in London in 1884. The Art Amateur in February 1882 declared that it could be washed and scrubbed, and curiously added, and after hanging in one place, can be taken down for use in other rooms. And so it was seen as something that could also be taken down and around with people from building to building. John Whitley set up at 31 Nassau Street near Wall Street before moving to Union Square. At the beginning of 1882, the press announced that a stock company was being formed to acquire and design patents in Lincresto Walton, and that Mr. Leprince, a Parisian artist of ability and an enterprising businessman, is to represent the manufacturers in New York. As a preliminary to this undertaking, he has fitted up some rooms in Union Square with great taste, employing the Lincresto in many ways for their decoration. The press noted that the directors of the company included several well-known men of high standing in New York. Amongst others, we may mention the names of H.J. Hoyt, who has resigned his position as president of the Graham Electric Company in order to take the presidency of the American Lincresto Walton Company; Clarence A. Seward, the well-known lawyer; Messrs. H.M. Hunt and James Renwick, the architect; S. Bayard Fish, nephew of Hamilton Fish, late Secretary of the Treasury; and H.D. Marquand, the banker and promoter of the Iron Mountain Railroad. Whitley and Leprince seemed to have a stellar lineup behind them. And so, what went wrong? What happened that caused Whitley to sell on his interest to the company Frederick Beck & Co.? It's always hard to tell with John Whitley, but one factor might have been something as mundane but fundamental as the pricing of the material. Despite all the talk about Lincresto Walton's affordability, it was still expensive. It wasn't until Frederick Beck & Co. took over and started to manufacture the product in the States that the prices dropped significantly, and the wall covering started selling well. And after John Whitley's failure, Lincresto Walton did manage to go from strength to strength under the firm Beck & Co. It became coveted, but it also became an example of a type of material that was facing scorn from cultural commentators, that of mechanically reproduced art objects. Throughout the 19th century, a grand debate was taking place in England and elsewhere concerning design and industry, art and commerce, that fought for the souls of artists and craftspeople and consumers. The arts and crafts movement, as it would come to be known in the late 1880s, rejected the seemingly relentless progress of modernity, rejected industry. Formed by textile designer, poet, novelist, and socialist activist William Morris. It attempted to preserve a perceived pre-industrial approach to the design and creation of crafts for the home. It was, in essence, a rewilding of the arts. Morris's own firms created and sold furnishings handmade by artisans, intended to be affordable, beautiful, and representative of the worker's own individual creativity, something supposed to have been absent in objects produced industrially. It was idealistic, certainly, and possibly naive, and often succumbed to the problems that items designed and created by hand became too expensive for most people, and so became ultimately bourgeois objects of desire. At the heart of the most powerful criticisms of industrial art was a brilliant and profoundly influential critic, John Ruskin. In his The Seven Lamps of Architecture, Ruskin had argued that decorative products that had been machine-produced were aesthetically and spiritually inferior to those that had been made by hand. He decried their imitative nature and railed against the short and cheap and easy ways of making things. They will only make us shallower in our understanding, colder in our hearts, and feebler in our wits. Ruskin, as well as many people associated with the arts and crafts movement, abhorred the industrially produced duplications of an original idea. As William Morris said, the real thing presently ceases to be made after the makeshift has been foisted onto the market. Where did the Leprinces stand in all this, being, as they were, artists in the traditional sense, but also involved in the brash new forms of mechanical reproduction with the creation of Lincrusta Walton designs? Lizzie Leprince wrote a booklet promoting Lincrusta Walton in which she said, "It is urged by aesthetic writers that no imitative machine stamped ornament can be good. While we admit the theory and argue that no stamped Lincrusta can ever give to an art lover the keen pleasure to be found in the chasing of a Cellini or a carving by Gibbons or a Goujon, we believe we are doing good work for art by making known a material exists within the reach of all, capable of recovering an infinite variety of hand decoration." These aesthetic writers Lizzie was referring to would have been people like John Ruskin. Lizzie's respectful defiance encapsulated the other side of the debate, which held that good design remained good design, and that affordable, accessible design had its own virtue. And she was not alone. There were others who stood by the newer forms of furnishing and lent it credibility. The respected designer Christopher Dresser, for example, would publish designs for Lincrusta Walton and indeed for linoleum as well. And another bulwark against the tides of criticism, and perhaps a cause of some of it, was simply the product's popularity. And with popularity came confidence. Lincrusta Walton was declared democratic because of its relative affordability, was declared modern, and an improvement in many cases on the materials it was imitating. Lincrusta Walton might imitate leather, but improved on it in the sense that it did not crack and could be more easily cleaned. It offered art at prices affordable, if not to everyone, then at least to the middle classes, and it was promoted without apology as modern recreations. As a painter's magazine and Coach Painter, for example, noted in 1888, it was seen as a modern idea, the products of a democratic age which seeks to chiefly ornament wall and ceilings in imitation of sculptures and reliefs of ancient times. Art in the past ministered to but a few who were lords of the earth. The temple and the palace were alone thought worthy of adornment. In the past, it was the few only who were noble. In the future, it will be the many, and art is rapidly becoming democratic in consequence. This new sense of availability of artistic works was a reflection of broader changes, progressive and relatively egalitarian, in everything from the redistribution of wealth to political enfranchisement. I am sure that the Le Princes would have admired Ruskin, and possibly they would have preferred not to have been disapproved of by him, as I suspect they felt they were. However, they were artists who were not afraid to align themselves with the artistic and industrial forces of progress and modernity. There are echoes within the story of the Le Princes and Lincrusta Walton of film, in the way that both film and Lincrusta fought to find a place in the cultural landscape, in the way that both artistic forms faced exile from the heights of high art, in the way that they nevertheless ultimately revelled in what was new and liberating about themselves. But there is also a more specific echo. During the period after John Whitley's departure from the scene, when Le Prince had gone into partnership with Charles H. Pepper, Lizzie's pamphlet on Lincrusta, which he had taken much trouble to write and illustrate, was published under the auspices of the New York Society of Decorative Arts, and for which we were to receive royalties on its sale in the state of New York. The purchasing firm printed and placed this pamphlet on the market as an advertisement, and so there were no sales and no redress. And so it seems that the Le Princes got a bad deal again. And after leaving the Lincrusta Walton business behind them, Frederick Beck & Co. achieved success with its new product. Widespread, lucrative, conspicuous success. Lincrusta Walton would go on to appear, for example, on the walls of the White House, the Rockefeller Mansion, and even in luxury cabins aboard the Titanic. I wonder how the Le Princes felt, being surrounded, as they would have been, by examples of Lincrusta Walton everywhere, knowing the fortune they might have made was now going to Beck & Co., and knowing the work Lizzie had produced was now benefiting that firm also, with no further compensation for her efforts. Would they have shrugged it off, more focused now on other projects? Would it have rankled? How much might it have hurt? And if there had been resentment at being surrounded by someone else's success with something they had worked on, might that have been a rehearsal for the greater and more personal pain that Lizzie at least would experience of seeing film become one of the most culturally and financially successful phenomenon of the age, and credited to others? The official website of Lincrusta has a history of the product. In it, there is no mention of John Whitley or Louis or Lizzie Le Prince. They have been erased from history, united in oblivion. Another small disappearance in this epic series of absences. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Shadow Traps. If you'd like to learn more about this project or to support it in any way, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theshadowtraps. Thank you very much for listening.